on my mind when I go home. The boys won't leave the girls alone. Pulled my hair and stole my comb, and that's all right till I go home. She is handsome, she is pretty, she is the belle of Belfast City. She is courting 1, 2, 3. Please could you tell me who is she?
A fine way to start our early St. Patrick's Day show. Guitarist Ian Gould, who is originally from Belfast and will be joining us for part of this hour, as will Tom Cannon, Irish historian, former president of the Irish Genealogical Society of Wisconsin, longtime executive director of Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee, and a man who's written over 100 articles on Irish history. Happy early St. Patrick's Day to all of you. This hour, Irish history, genealogy, poetry, and music. It's a tradition. I've done this show for as long as I've been on the radio, so that was a long, long time. Long, long time. We're going to have many parts to the show. We're going to start with our most eloquent man in the world, a St. Patrick's Day guest for the last 10 years, who passed away in February, but we have preserved his voice over the years and wanted to hear from him through past shows, so that's how we will start this hour. Francis James Joseph Raphael Delaney, Frank Delaney, Tipperary-born, best-selling author of 22 books, many of them a series of novels exploring his native Ireland's history in the 20th century, one decade at a time. He interviewed more than 3,000 writers for the BBC and international TV and radio shows he did. He joined the Northern Ireland region of the BBC in Belfast during the period of the Irish Troubles, wrote 6 books of nonfiction, short stories, radio plays, and it was our honor to talk to him for the past 10 St. Patrick's days. So we will start with Frank Delaney and then meet our other guests. This is Frank on How Ireland Captures Your Heart, and he also takes us back to ancient Ireland and New Grange, where the past is always present.
Oh, Ireland gets its hands around your heart. There's no mistaking that. It does it to me, even though I have fairly strong views about my own tribe or tribes who are still there. It gets its hands around your heart, and it kind of squeezes, and the grip is both warm and cold. What it does is it affects you essentially. There's something of the spirit in being Irish. It's a combination of one's instinctive knowledge of an ancient and deep past, of a magical people who were among the first civilized people in the west of Europe, certainly civilized enough to be able to celebrate death and the afterlife in that extraordinary tomb at New Grange,
yes,
which was built 3,300 years BC. And it's in the national personality. I mean, Kathleen, it's a country of 33,000 square miles. It would fit into Alaska 12 times, into California 8 times. And yet, today, it paints a huge, wide, green stripe all around the planet Earth. Everybody today wants to be Irish.
Isn't it true?
That has to be. That disproportion has to be a matter not just of personality, but a matter of imagination. And as we know, the principal tool of the imagination is the heart.
Yes, it is. I had been in New Grange, Frank, some years ago, and my whole family, we were blessed to go to Ireland this summer before last, and I had this whole itinerary, and I wanted to start with ancient Ireland, so New Grange was first on the list, and we drive up there, and it's changed. You can't just walk up to New Grange anymore. You have to go on a bus, and it was sold out.
I know. But it is still, in its own essence, an extraordinary place.
Yes, it is.
It looks in the distance as though the moon has come to Earth. Mm. Then when you go inside and you ascend, you don't realize you're climbing along that long, long passageway, and you finally get to the chamber and you see the bowl where on the 21st of December every year the sun comes to rest by sending a beam of light down the long passageway. The thing about it, to answer, and this answers your first question as well still, the thing about Ireland that I find extraordinary is the past is always present. You never get away from it. Every field has a history, and there is always someone to tell you the history of that field.
Right.
There's something about the past that never leaves you there. Maybe it's because it had to survive as an island. Maybe because it's been such a vital place for so long, with so much turmoil for so long. But whatever it is, that grip on the heart is prominent.
I did read The Matchmaker of Kenmare over the weekend. And
oh, my goodness.
I did, and thoroughly enjoyed it. I didn't know very much about Ireland's neutrality in World War II, but I love the book, Frank. You just weave these characters and the stories and the matchmaking. And is that a time in history that's of particular interest to you? And can you explain why Ireland was neutral in World War II?
Well, I was born in 1942, and they say that, you know, in your very early years, the sounds that you hear become the music of your life. And I know that I must have heard wartime broadcasts.
Oh.
I know that I must have heard the strains on the radio of the marching bands liberating Europe. I know that I must have heard the awful stories coming out of Buchenwald and Belsen and Auschwitz. And I know that I must also have heard the sighs of relief in my own family. We were neutral as a country. What else could we be? A tiny island with a tiny army and air force. No defense against anything. Churchill wanted our ports to harbor his fleets because in the early days of the war, the German planes couldn't reach that far. Germany thought of invading Ireland because it was 60 miles from England. It would have been a marvelous springboard for attacks upon England. But we had therefore to try and keep out of it as much as possible. That became, to me, emotionally very important as I grew up, because as I was taught the history of it in school, it seemed to me to make a statement that it was possible for a country, even as small as Ireland, to at least once in a while dance a jig on the world stage.
Mm-hmm. Frank Delaney, who's been our guest for the past 10 years on St. Patrick's Day. He passed away in February of this year, a hard loss for everybody, and we thought we would bring his voice back to you. Also joining us in our studio today, Tom Cannon, Irish historian, and he has written a number of articles about Irish history. He's former president of the Irish Genealogical Society of Wisconsin. Tom, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
And joining us, he's originally from Belfast. I love Belfast, and the accent, the Belfast accent, is just the best in all of Ireland, is Ian Gould, who started the show with some wonderful music. He began his musical career as a child playing in bands throughout Ireland. He studied in Paris and Scotland and has lived in several European cities. He is now residing in the United States and received his citizenship in November of 2015. He's played for the President of Ireland and many other luminaries. And Ian, thank you so much, and thanks for starting this show with great music, and you'll give us music during the course of the hour.
I certainly will. It's great to be here. What a beautiful view from the studio, I must say, too.
Yeah, not as pretty as Ireland.
Well, no. Our buildings don't really get this high.
I know. And the grass is not quite as green,
no.
Is it?
Well, certainly not at this time of the year.
Yeah, that's for sure. Tom, Frank was talking about the past always being present in Ireland, and I think that's true. It's probably true for a lot of countries as well. But the past really is in many ways present. How so, do you think?
Well, you know, Frank O'Connor, great Irish writer, said that the Irish have the backward look. That's the characteristic of, defining characteristic of Ireland. And it is true. They're just an ancient people on an ancient island, and they know and love their past in ways that others don't. A psychologist might say that they look to the past because they want to avoid dealing with the present. So, you know, there is another take on it. But for people who love history and genealogy, there just is no place better on the earth than Ireland.
And I know you've done a lot of work with genealogy. You were saying that the records have allowed many people now to trace this massive medieval genealogy, which we've discovered, which allows people to go way back with their roots, right?
Yes. The scholars in medieval Ireland began working in monasteries around the 7th century, and they tried to fit Ireland into the biblical and European pattern of peoples. And so they devised, among other things, not only a national history tying into the Old Testament stories, but also they devised these lengthy and elaborate genealogies that went all the way back to Adam and Eve.
Hmm. How far have you traced your family?
Well, you know, that's a good question. It depends on how you define tracing. In terms of you know, direct generation to generation documenting to about 1750.
Really?
But there's a kind of a dead period in Irish history that goes back to maybe the late 1500s or so, when the Irish were really, really oppressed and suppressed. And, you know, right before 1600, you've still got this vibrant Gaelic culture, which focused on and celebrated genealogies, among other things. So virtually nobody can bridge that gap, although in one of my lines, my McCarthy line, I think I've actually been able to bridge the gap. So from a McCarthy standpoint for me, literally back to Adam and Eve.
Oh, my gosh.
Although, of course, it's, you know, not biologically accurate.
Yes. Yeah. And is it hard for us to do that? Are there resources available now for people who want? I know I've done that DNA testing and discovered there's a lot of Spanish and Scandinavian in me, which somehow is related to Ireland, too. But you think you're 100% Irish with a little bit of German, and it turns out that Ireland had a lot of other influences and people who came in and took parts of the land over the centuries.
Right. I mean, Ireland was in some ways isolated, but in other ways, the ocean provided a highway to connect not only to Britain, but also to other European countries. And so you have a kind of a peculiar situation where they had trading relationships with the Romans and with Roman colonies like Gaul, for example, or Spain, modern-day Spain. But then they're also culturally isolated and linguistically isolated in many respects as well. So it's one of the fascinating things about Irish history. You can find support for almost anything, any proposition.
Ian, I'm interested in your take on this as somebody who grew up in Northern Ireland. Is the past always present? And if so, in what ways? Not always in good ways, I think.
Well, so yeah, with our history and certainly short-term history in Northern Ireland, the past being present sometimes gives us contention and things to argue and fight over. And I suppose in the positive ways as well. We recently just did our DNA stuff.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, and it turns out I'm Irish.
You are Irish. All right.
But again, you know, if you think about that also, I'm sure Tom and I were talking just briefly on the way up in the elevator there. I'm sure there's a lot of hard-nosed political people who would be shocked to find that their DNA doesn't tie in with their political beliefs. You know, I mean, maybe a hard-nosed Protestant may find that he's very, very, very Irish and not as British as he thinks he is. You know, or the flip side of that.
Yeah, it might help bring peace in the world
if
we all do our DNAs. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit, because music is such a big part of the Irish culture everywhere you go in Ireland, and it's celebrated here with our wonderful Irish Fest and with music all over, and you're a musician as well. Tell me about the musical influence on your life and both of you, why music is such a strong part of Irish culture.
Well, it's identity, isn't it? And as Frank Delaney was saying, we've painted this green stripe all the way around the world. I mean, Irish music is everywhere. And, you know, like everything else, we associate it with a good time. Well, you know, I guess I'll even argue with myself on that. I've often said that Irish, certainly songs, are about one of four things. You know, you've drinking, fighting, you know, the two negative ones, loving and dying.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily in that order, of course. So it's in every aspect of your life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think, and growing up, almost everybody I knew played some sort of instrument.
Mm-hmm. Tom, why do you think it's such a big part of Irish culture?
Well, I think it's a universal, and music is universal to all cultures. The Irish celebrated music maybe in a more profound way than other cultures, because they couldn't express themselves in the normal ways. They didn't typically have access to painting or sculpture because they were economically so oppressed but you could always get a drum, you could always get a fiddle, and you could play, and it was a way to allow expression that was foreclosed in other areas. You couldn't write, for example. Under the penal laws, it was a felony to educate an Irish Catholic. So, you know, your parents could go to prison if they taught you to read and write. So music provided an outlet for human expression.
Mm-hmm. And you started playing in when you were a child, right?
Yeah. Growing up, and we were all into rock music and, you know, and heavy metal even. So it was wonderful to get bands coming through like the Horselips or Thin Lizzy, who started to combine some of the elements of, you know, of traditional Irish music right in there with the progressive rock and pop music.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have you play a little music for us as we pause for a moment. And let me also give our audience a phone number if you'd like to talk about your favorite Irish poem or song or how you celebrate this day. Frank Delaney had some harsh words about how Americans celebrate St. Patrick's Day. We'll hear those later. And we'll move into Irish poetry. I love so many Irish poets, and he was the kind of guest who you'd say, oh, I like this poet, and he would just recite the poem from memory. I wish I could do that. So we'll talk about Irish poetry with Frank Delaney as we continue. Here's how you join our early St. Patrick's Day celebration, but after all, St. Patrick's Day is tomorrow, so it's not that early. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org, and we're on Facebook, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. What are you playing for us, Ian?
I'm going to do a little snippet of a new song about Belfast and my experience.
Great.
We stood high up on the hill that night. We watched the city burning. I felt as helpless as a child, and it made me want to cry. Down on the streets, those shattered hearts and battered minds, they keep us all here yearning. They keep us all from learning, and it made me want to fly. Up, up, up and away. I had to go, how could I stay? Stay here and wait for better days. Stay here and wait. Stay here and wait the time. Hi.
Ian Gould, who is originally from Belfast, Northern Ireland, our musical person for this hour, and a good one he is. We'll continue in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Our phone number is 800-486-8655 for you to celebrate St. Patrick's Day with us. One of my favorite Irish poets, I have many, but I love Seamus Heaney, and we talked to Frank a lot about Irish poetry and literature, and when I mentioned Irish poet Seamus Heaney, Frank, of course, could recite him by memory. Here's what he had to say during one of our interviews over the past 10 years.
Tell me, because I want to play a little Seamus Heaney here in a moment. I love Seamus Heaney.
What are you going to play?
Digging.
Digging between my finger and my thumb, the squat pan rests snug as a gun. Under my window, a clean rasping sound. When the spade sinks into gravelly ground, my father digging, I look down. Till his straining rump among the flower beds bends low, comes up 20 years away, stooping in rhythm through potato drills where he was digging. It's a wonderful poem.
Oh, my God, I love you. You're just incredible,
Frank. It's a wonderful poem.
It is a wonderful poem.
Yeah. And there's a wonderful colloquial line in the middle of it when the poem is moving along formally, and suddenly he arrests you with what you know was a local comment. He says, by God, the old man could handle a spade.
Yes.
Just like his old man.
Yes, yes. And that
My grandfather cut more turf in a day than any other man in Toner's Bog.
Mm.
Wonderful.
It is wonderful.
It'll be a treat to listen to that.
All right. Well, let's do that now. This is Seamus Heaney.
Digging. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests, snug as a gun. under my window, a clean rasping sound when the spade sinks into gravelly ground. My father digging. I look down till his straining rump among the flower beds bends low, comes up 20 years away, stooping in rhythm through potato drills where he was digging. The coarse boot nestled on the lug. The shaft against the inside knee was levered firmly. He rooted out tall tops, buried the bright edge deep to scatter new potatoes that we picked, loving their cool hardness in our hands. By God, the old man could handle a spade, just like his old man. My grandfather cut more turf in a day than any other man on Toner's Bog. Once I carried him milk in a bottle, corked sloppily with paper. He straightened up to drink it, then fell to right away, nicking and slicing neatly, heaving sods over his shoulder, going down and down for the good turf, digging. The cold smell of potato mould, the squelch and slap of soggy peat, the curt cuts of an edge through living roots awaken in my head. But I've no spade to follow men like them. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it.
That's wonderful, isn't it?
Isn't it? It is wonderful. And it must be so meaningful to you because that's what you do as well. You dig with your pen, don't you?
1 year, at this time of the year, we had a garden, a home garden, so to speak, attached to our house, about 3/4 of an acre, which is a lot to a boy. 1 year, for some reason, I think my mother hadn't been well, which is unusual. There was no illness in our house at all. My father took her away somewhere for a few days, and it was Easter. And I was at home from school. And every year we had a crop of potatoes. And that year, I put in the entire crop by myself. And that poem is exactly what it was like.
Mm-hmm.
Just cutting open the ground, laying out the drills, putting in the farmyard manure, the foot-long stick by which to measure the planting of the tubers from each other, fistfuls of lime then along the drill, and then covering the whole thing over. And then at the end of May, you see the first stalks coming up. And I can tell you, that's its own kind of rough magic.
Oh, it must be. Let's talk about the North for a moment. I'm fascinated that you covered the troubles in Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. It's such a hard time in the 70s.
Oh, wow.
When you said earlier on in this show that the past is always present, is the past still present in Northern Ireland in a negative way, or have people moved beyond that?
It's both. The Irish, I contend, and I think I say it somewhere in this book, The Matchmaker of Kenmare, are the only people I've ever known who can hold with equal passion two completely opposing, conflicting points of view. And that's what's going on there at the moment. Things have begun to change very slowly. For example, Kathleen, there is no longer a physical border. You can drive from the south into the north and not know when you have crossed. I know. I always know. But the checkpoints are gone. The roadblocks are gone. Mm-hmm. The concrete lumps across the road blocking the smaller unpatrolled roads, they're all gone. It's now an electronic border, but it's almost not a border at all. For example, more than 40% of all commercial property in Belfast is in Southern Irish hands. There are All-Ireland tourist initiatives. There's always been an All-Ireland rugby team. There's an All-Ireland cricket team. It's a different climate now. And part of this came about because of education. Slowly but surely, directly after the civil rights movement, the impoverished, both Catholic and Protestant working classes, began to get education. And of course, with education comes greater wisdom and greater tolerance.
Frank Delaney from one of our previous interviews. We'll talk about the troubles in Northern Ireland with Ian in a moment because, of course, he's from Northern Ireland. But let's talk about Seamus Heaney and the rich Irish literary tradition. I've asked both our guests to talk about their favorite poets. And again, as with music, the written word is so prized and used as it was with Frank. Frank was a great speaker, but so beautifully. Why, Tom? Why so rich?
You know, I think Ireland had a very rich oral culture and oral people are very interested in traditions and in the use of language and words, and they're able to memorize prodigious amounts of material because they're not focused on writing it and, you know, preserving it. Well, I don't have to remember that because it's written down. So they could remember poems with hundreds and hundreds of verses, genealogies with over 100 generations. And so they had these prodigious memories, which are characteristic of oral traditional peoples and cultures.
Do you have favorite Irish poets?
I think it's, in my opinion, it's hard to beat Yeats for a modern poet. His use of language is just stunning, I think. And even though, you know, his poems were written in the 1890s and early 1900s, they still speak today. I also have another favorite poem written by Sean Moore O'Dovagoyne in 1370.
Oh, my gosh.
It's a very famous.
You better spell his name.
O, and then D-U-B-H-A-G-A-I-N.
Okay.
It's a topographical poem, so it basically takes a tour of Ireland. And he goes to a certain place, and he talks about the families there, and he names them by name. And so it's kind of a travelogue, but it's also a catalog of all the prominent medieval Irish families, the chieftains that you meet everywhere in Ireland. Fascinating poem. It's been edited a number of times. So,
Frank talked earlier, and I know that you know a lot about this, about the Irish being such a civilized people so early on that they really had, even centuries and centuries ago, beautiful works of art and a strong kind of literary tradition, not written down necessarily, but all of that was evident on this little island for centuries.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was beyond the pale of the Roman conquest, and which had the effect of kind of suppressing or wiping out the vernacular cultures. So Ireland's vernacular culture is one of the few European cultures that didn't get squashed by the Romans. But then it also didn't get conquered by, for example, the Angles and Saxons like Britain did. And that was another influence that tended to suppress vernacular cultures. And so Ireland really was that, you know, outpost in the Atlantic that was free of the homogenizing influences of conquest until 1600, when the English finally triumphed.
Mm-hmm. And that relationship, of course, has been contentious and continues to be somewhat to these days. But it's hard to, I say this all the time and think about it, but this land that's so beautiful and with so much poetry and so much music, there have been, there's been horrible war there. There's been a great deal of hate there as well. And it's always hard to reconcile with the peacefulness that you see in the country. Tell me about growing up in Northern Ireland. Did you sense that at all, Ian? And tell me how things are now. Let me get your mic on. Hold on. Sorry.
I certainly think everybody sensed it because we were experiencing it. You know, I was born in 71, and, you know, it's there all the time. You know, I think we developed a lot of our very biting humor as a way to deal with the oppression of what was going on in our society, you know. Mm-hmm. And oppression is probably not the best word, but just there was constant fear, but you can't wake up every day and be aware of that. You have to move through your day as you would. You know, we see all these impoverished people throughout the world and little kids kicking a ball around in a third world country with big smiles on their faces because they don't know any different. Today it's wonderful, you know. I when I go home there, I see people who would have been at odds, maybe, you know, from different communities, sitting in the pubs together drinking, and it's as though, well, it's not as though it didn't happen, but it's as though people are saying, okay, this happened, let's move on.
Mm-hmm. Do you study it in school? Do people study it in school?
In school, certainly in my era, we were sent to either a Catholic school or a Protestant school. So if you went to a Catholic school, you got Gaelic language, you got Gaelic sports, you got Irish history. While if you were at a Protestant school, you got British sports, British history. So they wanted us divided to some degree. Maybe it's a controlling thing. Or
you know, the American press always focused on the religious divide, but there was so much more to the troubles in the North. And as Ian points out, you know, it was cultural, it was language, in addition to religion. So it's the British Protestant landlord class versus the Irish Catholic tenant class, and the economics and politics and language, and a lot going on there besides religion. In fact, they weren't fighting about theology at all.
And that goes way back, doesn't it? You've talked about how the fact that you couldn't read, you couldn't write. I mean, great poverty in Ireland for a long time. And there's people who had very fancy houses. And I just finished Frank's book, Tipperary, over vacation. And it was interesting to, and he does a lot of historical work in his novels, to look at how many people were burned out of their homes and sometimes killed to get out of their homes to move people off land that... British, what would you call them? Land class? What would you call them? Who wanted the land?
The landed gentry.
The landed gentry.
Yeah. Well, in 1600, when the English finally conquered, quote unquote, Ireland, there was a complete wholesale changeover in the ownership of land in the 17th century. And by the end of that century, basically, well, the Parliament passed law saying Irish Catholics couldn't own land. So, there's the British Protestants who came in and owned all the land. The Irish Catholics, who constituted 80% of the population, became peasants. I mean, my great-great-great-grandparents were tenants on the estate of the Marquess of Cunningham. 40,000 tenants working his land in Donegal.
40,000?
40,000. It's the largest landowner in Donegal, and I think the third largest landowner in the country. So
I think something to take from that is that there wasn't necessarily poverty. It was just the allocation of wealth and where that went.
Well, and that's a point that's often brought out in discussions of the famine. The kind of British view is that, well, it was a parasite that killed off all the potatoes. But even during the height of the famine, Ireland was a net exporter of food. And so the landlord class brought in the British Army to actually guard the trains going from the west to the port cities to make sure that the starving peasants wouldn't attack the trains and try to feed themselves and their families. So.
And then, of course, you have to ask why. Why?
Well, it was the whole Irish economy was hijacked to promote the British economy. And so there were restrictive trade laws imposed by Parliament against Ireland, so they couldn't sell their goods, for example, in Britain, because the Irish might actually earn money. And they didn't want Irish goods to compete with British goods or products, so it was very restrictive, and it just deliberately suppressed the country of Ireland. I mean, you can't have 80% of the people and say you can't vote, you can't be educated, you can't learn to read and write, you can't practice your religion, you can't sit on a jury, and expect that country to prosper. It was designed to deliberately keep Ireland under the British heel.
And so the anger builds and the anger builds and the anger builds over a long period of time. And finally, in the early part of the 20th century, it explodes.
Right. Well, it exploded in every generation, but successfully, it took Michael Collins to actually figure out how to do it.
Let's hear a song, Ian.
Sure. How about another one from Northern Ireland?
Okay. Absolutely.
This is an old traditional tune. Mm-hmm.
near the Banbridge town in the County Down one morning last July. Down a boring green came a sweet Colleen, and she smiled as she passed me by. She looked so sweet from her two bare feet to the sheen of her nut-brown hair. Such a coaxing elf, I had to shake myself to be sure I was really there. From Bantry Bay up to Derry Kay, from Galway to Dublin town, there's no maid as seen like the brown Colleen that I met in the County Down.
Ian Gould providing our St. Patrick's Day music, this early celebration of St. Patrick's Day. And we're welcoming phone calls if you want to join us. It may be the kind of show you just want to listen to, as I sure do. But if you'd like to join us, have questions about Irish history, or would like to tell us your favorite Irish poet or piece of literature or music, I don't want to exclude you from the conversation. So join us if you would like at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network. We're going to talk about James Joyce in a moment in honor of Frank Delaney, but Chris on Facebook writes, "This gentleman, I used to work with an Irish woman in Milwaukee, and she said to me, if you ever go to Ireland, take a bicycle, go around the country, and bang on doors. People will take you in and feed you." I have found that to be true, maybe not everywhere, but this is one hospitable country.
It is, and people love Americans. The Irish, one of the few places you can go where you are guaranteed to be welcomed with open arms. And, of course, the traditional Irish greeting you hear everywhere, Cade Millie Falsha, 100,000 mm-hmm. welcomes.
And so many people, tell us about the people who left Ireland when they started leaving. You have huge Irish populations in many cities in this country and also in Australia. It was a tiny island that lost so many people.
It was. In the 1845, right on the eve of the Great Famine, some estimates are that the Irish population was 9 million, and it dropped after that to about 4 million.
Goodness.
But even before the Great Famine, you had a emigration in the preceding 30 years of about 1.5 million people from Ireland leaving. So you had a lot of people coming to America in the 1820s, 1830s, mm-hmm. early 1840s before the famine. Of course, there were recurring local famines throughout Ireland almost every decade because there was just dependence on one food, and that's a recipe for disaster.
Mm-hmm. What about the hospitality? It is true.
Yeah,
Would you attest to that?
I would claim to be part of it. my father was forever frustrated in a humorous way, because I would always be bringing people home that I'd met. You know, oh, Dad, you know, look, here's a guy, and my friend came from, who I met in Ballycastle, and he was just loosely travelling, so I invited him to my house. So, you know, some Scottish people who were travelling I met in the city and said, oh, you could stay at my place, you know. So, yeah, we're hospitable.
You know, there's an innate curiosity as well in the Irish. It's often said that the three questions you are guaranteed to be asked when you go over there, what is your name? Who are your people, and where are you from, or where are they from?
Mm-hmm.
And once they get the name and the family and the place, they can kind of locate you in the constellation of their world and their universe. So those are the questions you'll be mm-hmm. sure to be asked.
Yeah, so better know the answers to those.
Yeah, we still do that here.
Do you?
Yeah, when I
do
meet
you
people.
Really?
And certainly when I meet people from Ireland,
uh-huh.
or you know, or the people who have generational connections to Ireland, they tell, I'm from Ireland. Oh, where do you know where you're from? And that all
right.
comes back.
Yeah, interesting. All right, I have to do this in honor of Frank Delaney, because Frank Delaney loved James Joyce, and he loved Ulysses. His first book was published in 1979, James Joyce's Odyssey, A Guide to the Dublin of Ulysses. It was a bestseller. And for the past 10 years, up until his death in February, Frank did a weekly line-by-line analysis of Ulysses. He thought it would take 30 years to complete, and I hope that somebody else, I don't know who else will do this, but I hope somebody continues with all of his hard work. He wrote that Joyce believed that the key to human nature lay in observing the commonest acts of man, ordering a drink, eating a meal, opening an umbrella, folding a newspaper, and we every year would talk about James Joyce with Frank Delaney.
I'm going to talk about Joyce a little bit, Frank, and admit that I mean, I've read Joyce, and I know we have listeners who absolutely love Joyce, and many people do. I know that you did this theater show, Rejoice. I find him difficult. I find him difficult to read, and I want to ask you a little bit about that show, if you've resurrected that at all, if it was hard for you to connect with Joyce initially, how people can connect with him.
There's some talk about my doing it again in New York off
really?
Broadway, I'm thinking about it, I'm looking at it again. But for example, last Saturday, the Wall Street Journal asked me to choose the 5 best books about Ireland, and the 5th in my list was Ulysses by James Joyce, and this is what I said about it. Try it again, be patient, and this time you'll finish. And this time Ulysses will repay the effort. Inside of these nearly 300,000 words written by the great semi-blind modernist lies a spiritual trove. Joyce's tenet, in the particular, lies the universal, he said, captures two beliefs that could power the world. There is no such thing as a person too unimportant for art's focus, and that love of fellow man with its attendant forgiveness does indeed conquer all. Reading about the urban peregrinations of the unaudacious Leopold Bloom on a single June day in 1904, you will encounter the English language in its widest variety, from the street patois of Edwardian Dublin to sentences and paragraphs as classically beautiful and vivacious as Mozart's notes. The point about Joyce, Kathleen, is you have to read him aloud, even to yourself.
Really?
And only then do you find out what he really was. Joyce was essentially a musician. He was a lovely singer. He came second in a great singing competition to John McCormack, the great Irish tenor. He had a lovely, light Irish tenor voice. But he wrote as though it were music. And once you start to read it aloud, you then start to find all the little connections that are running through it. He's like, you remember the science lab in school, if you took out a blob of mercury and you put your finger down on it? Well, it breaks up into tiny other blobs as perfect as the original little sphere of mercury. That's what Joyce is like. The moment you put pressure on him, he yields you a whole lot of other smaller beauties, and they have smaller beauties still, and more small beauties. And read him aloud, and don't be afraid of him. That's what I found. I wrote a book about Ulysses for people who have never finished reading Ulysses.
Did you? I didn't know that.
Yeah, my first book was called James Joyce's Odyssey, A Guide to the Dublin of Ulysses. I wrote a book about Ulysses for people who had never finished reading Ulysses. And the reason I wrote the book was I knew that if I had to write a book about him, I would have to finish reading Ulysses. So that's how I taught myself. The fact that I had to write about him meant I had to read the damn thing. Well, I fell completely in love with it. And it just has just about everything else.
Oh, Frank, thank you. I'm going to read Ulysses now.
Don't be afraid of it.
Okay.
Read it out loud to yourself. Dig into it. Take a paragraph at a time, if you can find a cohesive paragraph, and sing it slightly to yourself.
Sing it?
Be alone. Behave like a slightly mad person.
That won't
sing
be hard.
Sing it slightly aloud to yourself. It's not a stretch for me either, Kathy.
And I still haven't finished Ulysses. I hate to say, every time I hear him talk about it, I thought, oh, yeah, I've got to do this. And I know that my two guests, so I don't feel as badly, haven't finished Ulysses either. Did he give you encouragement to try once again, Tom?
He did. I don't know if it's enough encouragement because you need a lot to finish Ulysses. But James Joyce is kind of like the Bible. Everybody's got a Bible in their home, but very few people have read it cover to cover. And I think a lot of people have picked up Ulysses, or even worse, Finnegan's Wake, and tried to get through it and just, you know, couldn't force themselves to do. So it's a pity that we've lost Frank Delaney, who was such a wonderful guide. Yeah,
absolutely. Ian, it's music.
Yeah.
Ulysses is music. You have to read it.
I just thought of a wonderful idea. Actually, I'm really into audiobooks.
Oh.
I think I may have have to track down.
His podcast. He's got a podcast.
But I mean the Ulysses. Maybe I can get on an audio book and listen to it.
And then I can have
it as music.
Yeah, that's a really good idea. Drive in the car and
Indeed.
Listen to Ulysses.
Yeah. It's behaving like a slightly madman.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I know. Our number is 800-486-8655. Pat in De Pere. Hi.
Yes, hi. This is Pat and Sue from De Pere, and I'm calling to say hello to Ian. We are Jenny's mom and pop.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, hi, and we've drunk some of your beer at your house.
So he is a hospitable guy, Ian is, huh?
Oh, yes.
There you go.
He certainly is.
Testament.
I also wanted to know when you're going to be back at St. Brendan's in Green Bay.
I think sometime in April.
So you travel around.
I do. I just came everywhere. up from Florida last week.
Oh, you did?
And the people down there were complaining it was cold.
Oh, right. So at this time of year, you must have all kinds of
engagements. Yeah, it's nonstop. Yeah. That's okay. It's a good thing.
I'm sure. Thanks so much, Pat, for the call. William in Middleton. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'll try to make it short. There's a great book, Tacitus, the Agricola, the Germania. It was printed in 1948. And on it, it's the history of the Germans, and he says, we find a sea north of the Germans. Its sun lingers on here till dawn, with a brilliance that dims the stars. I believe that's the Gulf of Bosnia. On the right-hand shore of this sea, we find it washing the country of the Aisti, who have the same customs and fashions as are found in Britain. That's on page 139 of that book. So you say that you have some Scandinavian genes. I submit the possibility that you, in fact, are right. According to Tacitus, the Aisti were there in Britain and Ireland, and then came the Romans afterwards.
All right. Thank you very much. Filled in a piece of genealogy. Dawn in Oklahoma writes, listening to your last song, Ian, it struck me how deeply immigrants from Northern Ireland had an impact on the culture and music of Appalachia, particularly so of bluegrass, which shares the strong tradition of storytelling and its tonality and rhythms with its Irish progenitor.
Indeed. And not just Northern Ireland or Ireland in general. I think the British Isles. There's a lot of English and Scottish influence in a lot of the bluegrass music. Mm.
Let me ask you, we won't have time to hear this clip, but Frank would rail every year about how we celebrate St. Patrick's Day, getting up at 6 in the morning and go to bars all day, and he thought it was very racist, actually, was the word he used. It really is celebrated so differently. I celebrate it quite differently, and it certainly is in Ireland as well. Are you appalled by the way we celebrate, Tom?
I think you have to be a little appalled at the excesses, but Ireland always treated it Patrick's Day as a holy day, and so the pubs were closed. In fact, Brendan Behan has a wonderful story about trying to get a drink on St. Patrick's Day and having to go to Northern Ireland to get it. But it was more of a religious holiday there. Recently, maybe the last 15, 20 years, the St. Patrick's Day parade, a la the U.S. of A., has come to Ireland. And now you see not only Dublin having a large St. Patrick's Day parade, but even smaller communities, small villages even. And so they've been a kind of a case of reverse influence where the Irish, our celebration of St. Patrick's Day is now being influenced by what they see in America.
With Dallas cheerleaders, the last time I was there, I saw them. Thank you so much, Tom Cannon, Irish historian, for being with us. We want to leave with a song. Ian, thank you so much for all the music. And we have about a minute and 15 seconds, so give us what you will. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody. Thanks so much to Scotty Myers for producing the program and to Colleen Duvall for on-air production.
Oh, the summertime is coming, and the leaves are sweetly blooming, and the wild mountain thyme grows around the blooming heather. Will you go, lassie, go? And we'll all go together to Puyallup Mountain Time, all around the Bloomin' Heather. Will you go, lassie, go? Will you go, lassie, go?
Ian Gould, the music, we thank him for it, for this early St. Patrick's Day celebration. Thanks to Tom Cannon. Thanks to you for listening. News is coming up, and we'll talk about the Great Lakes, Hour 2.